Welcome to Eye on Horror, the official podcast of iHorror.com. This is episode 100, otherwise known as season 6, episode 1.
Woo!
We made it to triple digits, guys. How exciting. This is a big day for us. Yeah, it only took us 6 seasons, but hey, here we are. I am your host, James J. Edwards, and with me, as always, is your other host, Jacob Davison. How you doing, Jacob?
Doing good, and can't believe we made it a full century. 100 years of eye horror.
In dog years, maybe? I don't know.
Either way.
Also with us yet again, as always, is your other host, John Correa. How you doing, Correa?
Doing great. It's our centurion episode.
Centennial episode?
Centurion. We're not good at math or English, we're proving right now. I made a social media post saying this is our season 5 premiere. Apparently, we've already done 5 seasons. I don't know. This is our 6.
Unless we were wrong all last season. Did we skip a season somewhere?
It was easy to lose some time-space continuum.
Yeah. Time is but a construct.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah. We haven't talked in a while. We took our little season hiatus, and we have a lot to talk about. So if you like the part of the show where we just kind of shoot the shit before we get to a topic, I think you're going to love today's episode, because there's going to be a whole lot of that. And I want to start with something that's kind of old news by now, but I know all three of us have seen it. Megan.
Oh, Megan.
What did Megan. You guys think
of Megan? Let me go first. I freaking love Megan. I had so much fun with Megan. And a lot of people are saying it's like Chucky or Annabelle. It's like, no, this is Deadly Friend. This is Craven's Deadly Friend, but updated with, you know, the ending is pretty much telegraphed in kind of the way that the ending of Aliens is telegraphed. Actually, exactly the way that the ending of Aliens is telegraphed. But, I just had so much, but it's not real scary. It's just a fun throwback.
And that's the thing. I saw some complaints where people are like, oh, this isn't original. Oh, the killer robot sentient thing has been done. It's child's play. It's this, it's that. And it's like, yeah, that's fine. I'm all game for redoing something, but like putting your own spin on it. And I think Megan was very successful with that. I really dug a lot of the themes of fear of like technology and privacy and like the unkemptness. I mean, we had the recent Child's Play remake or reboot that did, you know, the Megan a robot and had that. And I like that with Megan, it's the reason why the AI is doing that is just because of pure negligence on the part of the creator. Like she knew, oh yeah, I should have put up these parameters. And Megan even calls her out on it. It's like, you just threw me together and expected me to like know what to do. And
here's your problem. This doll set to evil.
Yeah. And then on top of all that, it had this like nice campiness to it.
Yeah.
That had like those hints of like hagsploitation type humor that I just adore. So I had a lot of fun with it. For like almost no complaints. Was it a scary movie? And there were some parts that were like pretty gnarly, like she's chasing that kid.
Yeah. And also Megan is kind of scary, because I feel like they really nailed down the uncanny valley aesthetic with her, you know, because like she's this living doll. And I love that, you know, even in the movie people are freaked out by her the first time they see her. Like that camp counselor is like, oh holy shit,
oh, you're a robot, you're not another child. Yeah, I think you bring up a good point. They really use the uncanny valley to their advantage. Like they knew, like, all right, cool, like we're just gonna lean into it a bit, and effective.
Yeah, and Megan also is just a compelling horror character, because she has some pretty funny bits. Like, I still can't get over, you know, just like the creator scientist is saying, you know, just how she killed all those people. And Megan literally says, oh, big whoop.
And then the dance that's kind of gone viral. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that went on TikTok.
It went viral. It went on TikTok. And then but when the scene came up, I recognized the hallway from all those bits. And I was not expecting it to be used that way. Like, I thought it was going to be like something else. And then like, so the fact that she just did it to freak the fuck out of that guy was phenomenal. And the needle drops, the music choices in it. When she just starts singing Titanium, oh, dude, when she starts singing Titanium, I was like, there's going to be so many drag queens in WeHo dancing as Megan over the next few months. It's going to be gorgeous. This is going to be beautiful. I love it. And she started playing Toy Soldiers at the end on the piano. Come on.
One of the fun things about it, and I know that Jacob and I both saw pre-screenings of it, and they always, for these pre-screens, they put a slide up, which is usually a static slide.
Yeah, it's like the title card.
Yeah, it's like a title card. So this one, and when we're all sitting around chatting, wait for the movie to start, and one of the other critics that was there, she says, did that doll just blink? And we're all, no. You're imagining things. And then a few minutes later, Megan on screen says, thank you for coming to my movie, and scared the crap out of the whole theater. And
that's great.
And then every 5 minutes she'd say something like, remember to turn off your phone, or stuff like that. So the new batch of people that come in afterwards would get scared and everybody could watch them get scared. It was so funny.
And also she even did the keep your phones silent and don't talk during the movie or else.
Yeah. Well, she got nastier and nastier as I got closer to this. She's like, I'm serious. Turn your damn phone off. kind of a thing. It was funny.
Before we leave Megan, though, I want to talk about the most horrific scene in that movie. And that is when I'm blanking on the character's name, but the person who creates her, she opens a collector's toy box. And they're like, oh, just play with the toy. She could have easily just broken the seal, opened it nicely, kept the box intact. No, she fucking tears it to shreds. Why? She's like, oh, I'm a collector. I don't want this kid playing with my collector toys. And then she proceeds to shred the box like that. That was the gnarliest kill of the movie. It really was. The
gnarliest kill.
Gnarliest kill that I almost screamed.
Another thing that we've all seen that I think we're going to have things to say about is Knock at the Cabin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I just saw that one last night.
I have made no bones about being a Shyamalan fan. I mean, everybody knows I'm a big Shyamalan fan. And here's my take on Knock at the Cabin. I absolutely loved it until I didn't. And what that means is I was a little let down by the ending. I think it might be that I expect a little more from Shyamalan and his endings. And granted, this was based on a novel, so he may have been a little more true to the source material than it would have been had it been an original story that he had written. But I as the movie's going on, I'm trying to be vague because I think movies are better if you don't know what's going on with them.
I smell a minisode.
It maybe. at the center of it, and I was talking with another critic before we went in who was trying to explain to me the center of it without spoiling anything, because I don't watch trailers really, unless it's one that everyone's talking about and I have to see it. But the way he explained it is there's this ethical dilemma similar to the, if you could go back and kill baby Hitler, would you? And then his wife took it a step further and she said, it's not even that. It's like, would you kill baby Hitler if he was in a room of five babies and you didn't know which one was baby Hitler, so you had to kill all five of them? And I'm like, okay, and after seeing the movie, it's not quite that drastic, but that is the ethical dilemma at the middle of it. Yeah. And as it's playing out, it can go one of two ways. And if you've seen it, you know the two ways that it can go. And I think that it went the wrong way. I would like to have seen it go the other way. And I'm being vague, and maybe we'll get some spoilers with your guys' assessment of it. But the thing is, I was on the edge of my seat for the whole damn movie. I think Batista is amazing in it. I'm glad I finally see him in a role where he got something to chew on. And also really good is the little girl. Actually, I thought the whole cast was amazing, but mainly Batista and the little girl. I don't know her name. And more importantly, the way that they interact. Like the very first scene is where Batista meets the little girl. And that scene is just like so compelling. I mean, it's the perfect rope you in scene because, he knows why he's there and he's struggling with it. I don't know. Like I said, I loved it until the ending. And then I was kind of like, I didn't hate the ending. I don't hate the movie. I really liked the movie, but I thought it should have gone another way. What about you guys?
I got to say, I honestly, because I messaged you guys saying I have a lot of opinions about this movie. And so I got to say, I think it's probably the best thing that he's put out in the last like 15 years.
Really better than Split?
I like it. I kind of like it. I think it's more solid than Split, mostly because I have issues with Split. No, the acting's phenomenal. I thought Batista was great. All the characters, it was an interesting take on the home invasion story, because it was home invaders that were reluctant, but like needed to be there. Like they had a cause, they had a purpose of being there, but they were very reluctant about it. So much of the movie is just them trying to appeal on an emotional level for this family to make this decision. Yeah.
Yeah. They're struggling with themselves and with the family that they're tormenting.
Right. And I thought they did a really good job of, because if you've seen the trailers, you know what the dilemma is. We're trying to avoid, you know, talking about it too much in case you haven't seen anything. But there's this particular dilemma, and essentially the family kind of splits in half. You know, there's the, is this real? Is this not? And I thought they made some really compelling points on whether or not. But one of the, because the family that is being attacked is a same gender parents. You know, they're both gay men. And I think that's my only real, like, critique of it, is that they do a really good job of showing that this family is full of love, that there's a lot of like thriving in it, that, you know, in the daughter has this great moment where in the very first scene with Batista, where she's like, you know, she says, oh yeah, you know, Daddy Eric, Daddy Andrew, I have to do that to differentiate them so they know who I'm talking about. And he's like, oh, how does that feel? And she's like, it's good, except my guidance counselor says how great that is a bit too much, so I kind of get the feeling that it might not be, is how she's feeling.
Yeah, that she doesn't think it is. Yeah. Yeah, that was a great line.
There were so many great moments with that. But one of the things that there was so much thriving in showing the family. I was a little disappointed that one of the reasons why one of them is so doubtful that, you know, the dilemma is real, is that it's based in trauma of him being attacked in Boston. I was a little disappointed with that, in that it was just like, because some, you know, when it comes to portraying groups that have so much, that have had so much trauma, have had so much, it's we're at a point where it's just almost too much. You know, it's kind of like what Orange is the New Black, where it's just like every week it's another story of trauma, and we're not seeing stories of thriving. So I was just like, I understand why it was included, and I honestly don't know how you could cut it out. You know, but I was just hoping that wasn't an element of it.
The home invaders went out of their way. They even said at one point, they're like, you know, we didn't know the people who would be here were going to be a same-sex couple. They said that was a big surprise. That was out of left field. This has nothing to do with that. So they even know how what they're doing could be portrayed.
And I like that the couple were like, well, how do we know? Oh, I guess we're going to have to take your fucking word on it. Huh? You know? And, that's totally understandable with all that. And I do like how, especially Batista's character you could see him navigating his verbiage, you know, because he says that he's a second grade school teacher. And so he knows how to pick his words, and even says at one point how important it is, because children believe everything that you say. And so you have to you only have to speak in truths and stuff that you know as fact and things that of that nature. And you can see that line comes very later in the movie, but in looking back on the rest of the movie, you can see that he's been doing that this whole time and just trying to speak as like straightforward and with as much fact as he believes and knows. So
he's this big like wrestler type, you know, he's Batista, but you can tell from the first scene. I mean, it didn't surprise me at all that he was a teacher, that his profession was a teacher, because he's so good with her. And part of it, you're kind of going, okay, what's his angle? This is kind of creepy. But part of it is he genuinely cares about what he called his new friend, you know, the little girl.
Regardless of how people felt about the movie, I have not seen one complaint about Batista's performance. And personally, having just seen it, I think it may be his best performance yet. Like, it was very solid and just very against type, and just compelling throughout the entire story as it unfolds. Also, he only raises his voice like once during the movie. Like, he is very relaxed and trained through everything. And on my perspective, I gotta say, I I haven't seen a lot of Shyamalan's more recent work, but this is probably one of his best movies yet.
No, it's really solid. I really dug that. If I know Jay says he hasn't seen the trailers, but the trailers really do try to make it play up a bit. Like, it's a bit more actiony, a bit more thrillery, but I really like the idea. I always love the concept of like a home invasion story that's more philosophical than it is about like the violence, but still include the violence, you know, of course. But
it kind of reminded me of The Strangers a little bit, except not set at night, because a lot of it's in basically the broad light of day too. I mean, they even, you know, I mean, it takes place over a couple of days, and they even, you know, go to sleep. You know, they're like, you know, everything happens during the day. So it's not like a dark movie. Literally dark. But it reminded me a lot of The Strangers, you know, especially the whole, you know, why are you doing this? Because you were home. You know, I mean, that whole deal.
Had a bit of that vibe.
It is interesting because it is kind of genre disguised as another genre, because, you know, again, can't really get into it that much. But, you know, it's not just a typical home invasion movie. I mean, it is, but it turns into much more than that. And I feel it did it in an interesting way that kind of plays into being a home invasion movie, because it doesn't stop being a home invasion movie once you find out what else is going on, but it does just kind of add to the effect even. And I agree with Jonathan that, yeah, just does such a good way of portraying it without falling into a lot of the cliches, but also giving what people want, which, yeah, violence.
Like you're saying that, you know, the whole movie, along with the victims, the audience is wondering, you know, is this real? Is this not? Is this real? Is this not? And I think what I was struggling with the ending is I kind of wish that they went the other way. You know, when it's finally revealed as to the answer to that question, I was thinking it might, I wanted it to explore the other choice. And hopefully we have piqued your interest enough for you to go see it, because it is a great movie.
Well, and I think first of all, with that, the whole dilemma, no matter how you end it, people are always going to want the other one, aren't they? Right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
That's always going to be the case. But I also, there's also the other side of the coin where you're always thinking, man, what if it did end the other way? How would that have played out? And I think that this movie does that successfully, where it kind of gives you kind of like, there's some aspects of The Omen, where if you think about The Omen a certain way, where it's just a bunch of, you know, that he isn't actually the son of the devil. We know what the sequel said he is, but that it leaves just enough ambiguity that it's like, fuck, what if Damien wasn't the son of the devil and Gregory Peck is just trying to murder his kid? Like, when you think of it that way, it, you know, there is, that movie leaves a little bit of that ambiguity. This one doesn't, you know, with its decision, you know, it's very concrete at the end. But I do always like that, the idea of like, man, that would have been cool. It would have been cool. It would be a cool DVD feature, you know, to have like, oh, what if it went the other way?
Maybe that's my gripe about it. Maybe if it had gone the other way, I would want to see this way. I don't know. Because again, I'm a huge Shyamalan fan. I genuinely enjoy his movies. I can't really defend The Last Airbender, but the rest of his movies I've really enjoyed. I've actually gone up against a friend of mine who I always say that I'll put Shyamalan movies up against PTA's movies. And the only one I think that would win on PTA side is Boogie Nights, but we've had that discussion too. But yeah, maybe what you're saying is why maybe if it had gone the other way, I would have wanted to see the way that it had gone. Who knows? Let's move on to another big hit that the three of us have all seen. This one is kind of a viral hit. We've all watched Skinamarink.
Skinamarink-a-dinky-doo. I didn't know that it was based on that song until Lindsay told me after we watched it.
Yeah, no, I didn't either. In fact, like, just hearing that song through like clips on Twitter just gave me like flashbacks to PBS or something, because of that TV show, you know?
What did you guys think of Skinamarink?
An endurance test.
It very much is. Yeah. If you look up slow burn in the dictionary, it's the poster for Skinamarink. If you don't have patience, don't bother.
It does take a bit to kind of draw you in. But I saw it theatrically at Alamo, and I think, you know, there's a couple different ways to appropriately watch this movie, and theatrically is one of them, because, you know, we were in the dark, and I have never heard an audience so silent aside from screaming, because, yeah, just, you know, as soon as it starts, just everybody just kind of quiets down, and we get hooked into seeing what's unfolding. And, you know, as the tension's building, just people could barely, you know, make a sound. Like, I could have heard a pin drop in there. It was so quiet.
That's the thing. It's not, I mean, like, it's a slow burn, but that doesn't mean that you're bored with it. It is, yeah, like, right. I mean, I watched it on Shudder, but I did have all the lights out, and it was late at night. It was after I had finished working. So I'm watching this at like 11 PM, and it is, you know, it's engaging. I mean, you're the entire time you're like, okay, what the hell's going on? And then you're like 45 minutes into it, and you're like, oh, I still don't know what the hell's going on, but I'm still invested enough that I want to find out what the hell's going on. And it's weird, because it's almost like a student film that just like trods along. And it's the kind of movie where you look at it and you're like, oh, I could have done this. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, but that guy thought of it first. But, you know, you're like, you're all, this is one of those movies that, like, it's creative in its creativity. You know, and if that makes any sense, it's like the who would have thought to shoot this movie like the way he did, yeah. You know, like, if you were going to take the concept of, you know, these two kids, you know, in a house alone, essentially, would you have made that movie? It's just, I don't know. It's a fascinating, it's almost like an experiment, I would say.
Oh, it's definitely experimental. I mean, and when I say that it's endurance, I realize I just shouted out some words with no context. It's a positive. I thought it was phenomenal. I was telling Lindsay that these aren't the type of films, these type of experimental films, I don't really seek out too often, but I am always happy to experience them, because it does. It's different. It challenges me as a viewer, and it really is an endurance test because of the atmosphere it almost immediately builds, and it doesn't, there's not a lot of like peaks and valleys with it. It just kind of stays constant. So you're just constantly in this state of like, fuck, what's there? And you're constant, it forces you to constantly look in the dark, to constantly look at these like the grains of like the film, and to you're just always looking for something.
Yeah, totally. And the thing is, I don't know if it was my imagination or if the filmmaker actually digitally manipulated the images. But yeah, you're right. You're like, the camera will just be, and it's almost like it's sitting on the ground or something. I mean, it and then you'll start seeing things, and you're like, okay, is that me or is that the movie? Yeah, it's really, it's a creepy movie.
I think you only see one face the entire movie. Like, the entire movie is shot looking in corners. It's looking at objects and thing. It's always a different angle than what you, it's not shot how you would normally think something, a movie would be shot, and it doesn't play out like it. There's long takes where it's just sitting there, and then the camera moves to reveal nothing, and then, but you hear a voice, and then it goes the other way. And yeah, there's just so many interesting choices. And I had this weird thought and sitting there, because when a new movie comes out, there's always that person like, when's the soundtrack going on vinyl? There's no fucking soundtrack to this. But Skinamarink would make for a fantastic haunted house album. You just put that entire fucking audio play on a vinyl. Could you imagine that? Just like that playing in someone's house? I'd fucking jet. Also, those kids, wow. I would not have handled that long with whatever the fuck was going on. I would have been freaking out that first night. Would not be building Legos to any of that.
About halfway through, I realized, I'm like, oh, you know what? This is what it feels like to be a kid and to be scared. You know, like it brings you back. You're like, okay, you know, this is, you know, that's what makes it scary, is the fact that it takes like childhood trauma. It's basically, you know, childhood nightmare, the movie, you know, is.
Yeah, no, I think just rewatching it reawoken some kind of kinder trauma of, you know, like waking up before everybody else and watching TV by myself in the dark and seeing weird shit. I don't know what to put into context, and just getting freaked out by the dark. Like, it just really kind of unlocked those memories and just kind of has that style that really brings you back like that. It is kind of creepy how, you know, how nightmarish it is for, you know, people.
And it has one amazing scare that guys both probably know what I'm talking about. It's a cheap one, but it is so effective.
The telephone?
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel confident in saying that and not spoiling it, because there's a bunch of telephone stuff. But yeah.
No, there's a bunch of telephone, but yeah.
No, that got me.
It was so funny because, like, yeah.
That got me because we tried watching it the other night, and because of my work days and stuff, I fell asleep. Never a sign of quality, me falling asleep during a movie, by the way, for people out there. Oh, you fell asleep, it's a bad movie? No, that's not a factor. I'm just a sleepy boy. So I woke up super early for work the next day, or yesterday, and so I was watching it in the dark at like 5:30 in the morning. And when that bit happened, I fucking jumped in my office chair, was just like, oh, shit, okay, yep, you bastards, you got me. But yeah, I really enjoy how much of that film is up to interpretation, but there were like some really concrete themes there, playing with kinder trauma, playing with themes of, you know, the house is supposed to be a safe space for children and this isn't. So there were hints and themes of abuse in there, of divorce, and that effect on children and them trying to create that space. But yeah, I mean, who hasn't been like a kid up late and you're trying to be quiet, trying to not wake your parents? And so you have the lights off, or you have the TV very low, or you're trying to play with your toys very quietly, and you're just like listening for sounds like, oh no, if I woke them up, they're going to be upset. Or even just like, what was that sound, you know, in the over there? And you start seeing things in the dark corner, you start hearing things in the absence of sound. And I thought that movie was phenomenal in playing with that. Would I watch it again? Not for time, probably, you know, because again, it is an endurance test. But I didn't see it in theaters. I waited for the shutter for the sheer fact that I knew it was going to be a quiet movie. And the last thing I wanted was to be watching it and hearing fucking, you know, Dom and all the Fast and Furious people next door or whatever big action film or Avatar coming from the theater next door, ruining it, you know, but that was just me.
Yeah, again, I was fortunate, and I think that's why Alamo was such a great choice, because they're very careful about noise control. Because, you know, that the audience I saw with, you know, just got dead quiet while we were watching, and they were just as enthralled as I was. So it was a pretty good experience.
Have either of you guys seen Sick?
No.
Is that Kevin Williamson?
Yeah, the Kevin Williamson one. It's on Peacock.
Yeah, I was going to say it might be on Hulu, but yeah, I guess Peacock. It is basically it's about these two girls who quarantine hits, and they have to, you know, lockdown hits, and they have to quarantine. So they go out to this cabin to quarantine, and then it just becomes a slasher from there. And the motives of the slasher are, you know, they're well defined by the time you get to the end. But it's pretty much a typical slasher movie. It doesn't have a super high body count, but it leans real hard into the whole mask up vaccine, you know, it leans hard into the COVID thing, which is probably why it's called Sick. I mean, you could have made this movie and, you know, it could have been called, you know, Summer at the Lake or whatever, you know, and, you know, it's okay. I'm not loving it as much as everyone else, because I think I've seen so many slashers that there was really nothing new about this one, except the fact that it was set in COVID times, but you know,
are we over COVID movies?
I'm not. I mean, if they're done, the problem with them is, and actually at this point, 3 years in, maybe this isn't a problem. But what I think about is when, as soon as This Is Us, the TV show, which yes, I watch, take my horror card away if you want.
No, that's fine, dude.
They have like masks and vax and stuff, you know, as part of their show. And watching reruns of that might look like a time capsule rather than timeless. But now that it looks like, you know, COVID may be here to stay, maybe it's not going to look as dated as I think it is.
I just feel, cause like I was interested in seeing Sick, but you guys know me, I've been working as a COVID admin in film and television for the last few years. And definitely for me, it was just like, I don't want to spend my off time thinking about work. And like the second it's mentioned, suddenly it's in the head of just like, you're not. And then I get upset about, you know, oh, the character's not practicing good protocols or whatever, you know, stuff like that. And I understand that it's definitely a big part of the ethos. It's definitely a big part of like what's going on, you know, and understandable. But like also, I think I'm just exhausted from all of it. And it's more so just that whole time of it not being addressed and then like it being addressed, not being addressed well. I mean, In the Earth was phenomenal. I think that's the best movie to, about COVID to come out during COVID. But I mean,
I think Host is.
Yeah. I liked Host, but I liked
the thing about Sick. It's funny because at one point the girl is running from the slasher guy and she finds a car and she goes to the girl. She goes, let me in. And the woman driving the car is like, where's your mask? And she won't rescue her without a mask. It's kind of, I thought that was kind of funny. I'm like, oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I do want to check it out. I just, I haven't had the chance to watch it on Peacock. And in terms of COVID movies, you know, I feel like it's still something that, well, you know, just got, well, like, yeah, of course, the pandemic is still something people are grappling with. I just mean, you know, especially because that this movie is set during like the early parts of the COVID pandemic. And I feel like we're still reckoning with what happened in 2020. So I feel like if anything, you know, like the arts are kind of the unconscious of pop culture. So I feel like we'll be seeing more kind of period pieces set during that time as we still kind of deal with everything that happened since.
I think filmmakers are getting more creative with it because, you know, like we mentioned Host, but also Skinamarink was probably a product of that kind of filmmaking as well, where, you know, you basically you can use a single location and a single camera to do this kind of a thing. But, you know, like dash cam was another, you know, I think they're getting more creative with how they make movies because they have to, you know, in order to get your movie made.
And also Pearl kind of dealt with it too, since it was set during the 1910s flu pandemic and was made during pandemic quarantine in New Zealand.
The whole reason Pearl exists is because of quarantine, because Mia Goth and Ty West were like, let's write a movie.
Which, don't get me wrong, I'm not against like the like technical sides of like things getting made or how they're getting made because of it, or even just like a film being used as a way to process what's been happening with COVID. I think it's more just the gimmick of it. And I think that's why I haven't watched Sick yet, is it felt like exactly like, oh, it's a slasher, but it takes place during COVID. And it's just like, you know, rather than it being a process, it's just, yeah, I think I'm over the gimmick of it, you know, because remember how we had like Songbird, or even that like heist movie with Anne Hathaway, where it's just like, oh, it's this, but during COVID. It's, I think I'm exhausted of those movies, or the thought of those movies, because I don't want to like pigeonhole Sick or any other movie as, oh, it's this, but with COVID. But there are definitely those movies, and I'm just, yeah. But on the other side of it, like, you want to talk about processing, Last of Us. Have you guys been watching Last of Us?
Oh, yeah. No, it's been amazing.
Oh, that's been processing. First of all, fucking phenomenal. Holy shit. I think only episodes 1 through 3 are out. So that's as far as we've got.
Yeah, the fourth episode airs tonight.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Oh. So I'm not too far behind. I just caught up on White Lotus. I don't know if you guys watch that, but
I do.
We watched the first season of that in one sitting, and so we're spacing out season two as much as we can with White Lotus. Well,
season two's got your girl Aubrey Plaza in it.
Oh yeah, it does. Well, yeah. It's also got my main queen, Jennifer Coolidge, in it. So.
She's in both.
She is.
Yeah.
Fucking love Jennifer Coolidge.
She might be the only carryover. Is she the only one who's in both?
Yeah, she's the only one who's in both seasons.
And actually, Last of Us does have Armand from season one of White Lotus to give you more motivation to watch.
That's true. There's a connection.
Jesus Christ, Last of Us is so fucking good. I cry so much during that show. Goddamn.
Do you have to be familiar with the video game to watch it? Because I don't know anything about the video game. Okay,
no. I played the games, and like they really establish it on their own. And since it's Craig Mazin, the guy that did Chernobyl, he does a few things that you may kind of notice similar to how he handled the disaster in that show with this. Like there's a couple of cold opens that kind of examine and display kind of the sheer scope of what a disaster they're in because of the cordyceps infection. So it's basically, you know, just this fungus manages to adapt to humans, and it spreads in such a viral manner that it's able to infect millions of people simultaneously. And that's what kind of kickstarts the collapse of society and And the other thing is it's a period piece too, because it's, well, the outbreak starts in 2003 and it's set in modern 2023, but in a post-apocalyptic version of our world.
Yeah. And what I really love about it, first of all, the game is phenomenal. I have never beaten that game. I always get to, I don't think I've left quarantine in it, because I would always play it and then something would happen, like I have to return the disc, or I had to, I got distracted with work. So I only ever got so far four different times across two different consoles with it. And so by the end of episode two, I turned to Lindsay. I was like, and that's as far as I got in the game. But what's great about it is the game is phenomenal. The game is so focused on character and so focused on story. So it is already very cinematic. It's very episodic, the game. And they respect the shit out of the game. They had one of the creators of the game be an EP on the show and is very involved with it. And the EP's even said, because I've been watching the after shows, that when they're talking about adapting the game, if they can do, if when they deviate from what the game does story-wise, if it's the same or worse, they don't do it. But if they can improve on a bit in it, like they change one of the characters, like his story, his involvement in the overall story drastically in the show, but it's in service of telling a much better story. And yes, I am referring to episode three, which is a real fucking tearjerker. But it's, yeah, it's when, oh, Jay, you got to catch up, man, because episode four premieres tonight. It's so good.
Yeah, I definitely need to get into that. I've just been, I've been busy with stuff, but yeah
we got,
I
can get into it.
What else you guys been seeing? Anything else cool that has come out?
Well, I did see the new Brandon Cronenberg movie, Infinity Pool.
Ah,
how's that? White Lotus for the Videodrome Fest, eh?
Is that what it is?
Is it? Because I said that, and I haven't seen it yet, but...
It kind of is, because it is about, like, Alexander Skarsgård and Mia Goff and all these other, like, ridiculously wealthy white... like millionaires vacationing in this third world country resort and them getting into trouble. I don't want to spoil I don't want to spoil kind of the sci-fi twist to it, but yeah, no, they let's just say there's a way they can avoid consequences with their massive amount of wealth and they start getting addicted to it. And I thought Brandon Cronenberg did a fantastic job of, you know, kind of building this world and kind of it's not really a body horror movie, but it is a very dark science fiction kind of moral examination type of movie. And he's very good with kind of the lore and world building of it. And also I just really love seeing Mia Goff just go 110%, because like she goes as hard as she possibly can in this role.
I finally saw Holy Spider. I know reviewed it a few episodes ago, and I gotta say, believe the hype, that Holy Spider is fucking phenomenal. If you can find it in a local theater, go see it. It's wow, just blew me away. I will watch anything that director does now after Border and that, and Holy Spider, phenomenal.
Have you guys seen Pray for the Devil?
No,
nah.
It
is that the one about like the they treat like exorcists like soldiers of the Vatican? And like,
oh, it's, yeah,
like
a little bit, a little, and, like, bit, yeah,
she's the first female exorcist or something, but the devil's trying to, that trailer is one. So hokey.
Yeah. I'm, yeah, sorry. The movie is hokey too. Yeah.
Is it hokey?
No. It's just kind of bad hokey. And it's weird, cause I mean, I don't feel bad because, you know, I supported horror, but it was offered to me as one of my offers on Vudu. And I don't remember what I paid. I think it might have been like $9.99, and I think I got ripped off, but, but it was, maybe on a second watch, it'll be fun, hokey, but, it was just, yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those, you can't be an exorcist, you're a nun, you know, and then there's kind of a fun little twist that you see coming a mile away about, you know, why this woman has to be the exorcist for this, you know, particular case. And it's not worth talking about too much, because it's not really a good meet. I was expecting it to be better because it was kind of hyped. There was a lot of hype around it, but
if you do want to watch a good nun movie, I just watched Benedetta for the first time.
I've seen it. Yeah.
Oh my God. I finally popped in like my import 4K of it on Thursday night, and Paul Verhoeven goes hard. Yep. Paul Verhoeven, bud.
All you need to say about it is Verhoeven.
Oh my God. You know, finally there was something that like would work as a double feature with The Devils. I think that's the highest compliment I can give that fucking movie.
The greatest nunsploitation double feature of all time.
Oh, yes. My goodness. Like, what a phenomenal performances, the cinematography in it, the writing, that's just phenomenal.
The jester that farts fire.
And there's a part of there's the Jesus scenes. My goodness, it's blasphemous, but also not. It's what a feast. That film was a feast. And I gotta say, like, one of my favorite things was reading like little factoids, and like the original screenwriter put a lot of like themes about women and getting power and all this stuff, and like took out a lot of the lesbian aspects of it, and Paul Verhoeven put it right back in, and it was just like, yeah, there's a second title to that book, and it's called the Lesbian Nun of Italy or something like that, and he's like, and I'm not gonna do that second title a disservice. And boy did he not. Like, damn, like, it's not horror, but like Benedetta, like, if you're disappointed with your recent nun watchings, it's because you're not watching that movie.
And in terms of recent releases, Jason Eisner's Kids vs. Aliens came out, and I saw it last year, but you know, I was such a fan, I had to see it again, so I saw it at Alamo. And yeah, no, just really hoping Eisner gets more work, because he does such an amazing job of taking a concept and going as hard as he possibly can with it, because Hobo with a Shotgun was like the ultimate grindhouse throwback, and Kids vs. Aliens is the modern day Monster Squad with kids fighting some freaky ass fire in the sky aliens.
Speaking of kids, did either of you guys see Spirit Halloween, the movie?
No.
This is... basically, it's what you think it is. It's a bunch of kids break into a Spirit Halloween store to like basically spend the night there. They're getting a little too old for trick or treating, so they want to like have some real fun, quote. So they break into this thing, and it's kind of a possession movie a little bit, because the spirit of the founder of the town or something like that, he basically jumps from item to item in the Spirit Halloween store, and it also can go into people. It's a pretty fun little movie. It's definitely made for kids. It's like a, you know, it's a Monster Squad kind of a thing. So if you're in the mood for that kind of thing, Spirit Halloween the movie, it's pretty much exactly what you think it is. They made a movie about a Spirit Halloween store, but they found a good way to do it, because you know, there are possessed skeletons and possessed monster dolls, and you know,
and it's silly fun.
It's fun. Yeah. I mean, hey, more fun than Pray for the Devil.
Fair enough.
Hey, there is so much space for just silly fun movies, and anyone who says that is a mark against a movie, I will fight you in the parking lot.
It's not quite as much fun as Megan, but what is?
I mean, fair enough. It's a high bar.
Yeah, Megan is a high bar.
True.
So with that, let's move on to we're going to throw it back to our first episode ever with this episode 100. And this is timely because the Oscar nominees were announced, and there's no horror, not a single horror nominee. And it's kind of disappointing, because I thought for sure Mia Goth stood a chance. And also, but you would think that something like Nope would have gotten for visual effects, or I'm shocked that Bones and All. How did Bones and All not even get a nomination for adapted screenplay? I mean, that's like the miscongeniality of the Oscars. I mean, Nightcrawler got nominated for that, and that got snubbed in everything. But anyway, yeah, disappointing.
It's all the more insulting because if you guys remember, like a month or two ago, the Academy shared on social media Mia Goth in Pearl, the shot. So it really fired everyone up, like, oh shit, is Mia gonna get at least a nomination this year? And then nothing. So like, what, like, you done did us dirty. But I mean, yeah, this is it felt right. Well, it felt right, but it didn't feel good revisiting this topic for our 100th episode, because we did talk about this five full seasons ago, because this is our sixth one now. And that was, what, 2018? So it's been 5 years since we've been talking about this. So to have to revisit this topic of horror not getting the accolades that it needs, or even the recognition, is heartbreaking. Especially since, again, how many times have I said it? Horror is just a category. It's just a way of filing stuff away on the shelf. You know, you can still tell compelling stories. You can still give compelling performances. I mean, fucking look at anything Flanagan has done. Jesus Christ. Like, every single one of his projects has had insane performances, insane writing. And yet, where's the Oscars? Where's the Emmys, you know, for that? And then, yeah, this year, Mia Goth just
Thought we were making headway.
Yeah, Shape of Water in one the Best Picture.
I mean, we thought we were making headway with it, but it's like, I mean, and there's all that controversy with Andrea Riseborough basically forcing her nomination. I mean, they're not going to rescind her nomination, but supposedly she broke some rules about contacting Academy members directly, you know, and stuff like that. And people are saying that the real victim of that, of her nomination, is Daniel Deadweiler for Till or Viola Davis for Black Panther. But I kind of think it's Mia Goth, you know, and people are making it a whole, you know, Oscar so white thing because the other two actresses that didn't get nominated are Black. And honestly, both of them, I think, should have been nominated. Daniel Deadweiler, particularly for Till. But Mia Goth, absolutely. That's a huge snub. Anybody who sees. And the thing is, I don't think enough Oscar voters saw Pearl. You know, it's probably something that they just dismissed a slasher movie, you know, because Oscar voters have actually said that. They've said, oh no, I'm not going to even watch a horror movie.
Well, and I think one of the big issues with the controversy of her getting the nomination using a grassroots campaign, because a lot of it was her friends were hosting screenings and getting people to watch it and doing, you know, it was a real grassroots campaign. And what it really comes down to is who's got the money to pay for it. I mean, let's not forget that Dr. Doolittle, the original Dr. Doolittle, had like fucking 10 nominations, and that movie sucks. That's a terrible fucking movie. It did horribly at the box office, and it got that many nominations purely because the studios were pushing it. They were giving dinners, all that stuff. And that's what a lot of these nominations come from, is who can campaign the hardest with money, you know?
Well, that's the thing. It's not set up to be grassroots. It is set up like the rule she supposedly broke was contacting Academy members on her own rather than going through the Academy. Well, to get the Academy to contact them for you, I think it costs like $2,000. So basically, I think she skirted the rules to avoid paying the Academy, and she's got enough A-list friends that it got the word out. And that's what I think the Academy, that's the rule that I think that she broke, but they're not going to rescind her nomination. I mean, that would just be a PR nightmare, because, you know, as pissed off as some people are about the nominations, it'd be a worse black eye for them to say, yeah, no, we messed up and she's not nominated. And I haven't seen To Leslie. I don't think a lot of people have seen To Leslie. Well, maybe now they have because it got nominated. But I know that in either of my critic groups, they didn't send us screeners of it. No one I know saw it until she got her nomination. So it is an under the radar movie, or at least was an under the radar movie that no one had seen except for her A-list friends that hosted screenings, I guess.
But also, like, even then, like, why not? Like, why can't, why? And that's the thing too, is that we see all these other award ceremonies. Like, you know, you have the Spirit Awards that focus more on these indie films, and
Golden Globes,
and or even the Golden Globes is a bit more. They have a lot of their own issues too. But I mean, even so, like, you know, you have to turn to other places in order to get these, because the Academy, you have the whole gatekeeping of just the money to campaign for it. But then on top of that, there's a certain mindset with a lot of voters where they're just like, nah, a lot of them don't even watch the nominees. Like, can't tell you how many times I've read articles where they're like, yeah, I just guessed which short looked best, or which, you know, short had the name attached to it. you know, and it's so fucking ridiculous. And
yeah, so many of these decisions are so arbitrary.
Yeah. Especially things like shorts, like you said, that where, you know, that quote don't matter as much. Documentary is probably another one where they're like, oh, I didn't watch all those. I just thought Fire of Love looked the best, you know, which I'm trying to tell myself that's why Moonage Daydream and Goodnight Opie didn't get nommed.
But it also leads to other categories that people, because, you know, everyone's thinking about Best Picture or the Best Actor, but like you can tell by the nominees and how things vote, like who's going to get like Best Sound Editing and stuff, because a lot of voters aren't paying attention to that when they're thinking of that category. They're just going, oh yeah, this was a really great movie overall. I'm just going to check them on everything, you know.
The number of sound awards that Christopher Nolan's movies have won tells you that the Academy knows nothing about sound.
Yeah.
And this is coming from a sound guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Mia Goff even acknowledged kind of the Academy's aversion to horror. Like, she'd been doing some interviews and she even acknowledges it too, you know, that there's kind of a stigma against horror in the entertainment industry, and especially among kind of the critics and tastemakers. And, you know, just the wildest thing, though, is that this was not always the case. Like, you look back in the history of the Academy and of Hollywood, like, horror was acknowledged and even won awards. Like, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, the head actor, Frederick March, won Best Actor for that one when that came out. And, yeah, a lot of stuff was also pre-Hayes Code. So I think that, you know, there was this kind of... you know, a changeover where, you know, it's like, especially post Hayes Code, like horror was really defanged and not acknowledged. So I feel like that's probably a factor. But yeah, no, even today, and there's amazing horror movies and performances in horror movies, but there's still this stigma. There's still this aversion to horror by people because they consider themselves above it, or it's just, it doesn't fit that kind of mold.
Even the ones that do get nominated, like currently, like Shape of Water, it was like subtle horror. I mean, it's a creature feature, but there's a bunch of other stuff involved that they had, you know, to sneak it by. Silence of the Lambs, you know, it's about not one, but two serial killers, but they had to make it a psychological thriller in order to get it by. Did Sigourney Weaver get an Oscar nom for Aliens?
I don't think so.
Okay. But that would have been the exception that proves the rule, though, because there's nothing subtle about Aliens.
But it's just insane. And especially when you're thinking about obviously everyone's upset about Mia Goth, and rightfully so, but Nope really should have been nominated for a lot of technical awards as well. The technology and techniques that they did to pull off those shots of not just doing day for night, but like the lighting was insane and the detail, but still keeping it dark on what they did. I feel really bad that I'm blanking on how they did it, because I watched a video on how they did it, but it was insane. Like, just seeing like the set and seeing like, holy shit, that's how you lit it. That's how you lit this huge space for these shots at night. And you can still, it's still very dark, but you can see everything. That's insane. Like, just thinking about it.
Oh, and James, you were right. Sigourney Weaver was nominated for Best Actress for Aliens.
I was going to say, we were both looking it up. Yeah, she was nominated, which is a huge surprise because Aliens, I mean, yeah, there you go. So, there, that's the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah. But going back to it, I think it's an institution, right? It's the Academy. It's like politics, man. There's just too much of the old way in the way of like seeing much progress, and it's weird because there's the sponsors, there's the television of it, there's the televised, there's so many factors on why it's just not working well anymore. And it, unless there's a complete overhaul, I think we're going to keep bitching about the Academy Awards for decades to come. Cause I mean, I'm still forever pissed off that Do the Right Thing lost, you know, and that was before I was born. I'll always be mad that There Will Be Blood didn't win everything. So I think this temporary solution, or at least the thing that we can be doing as people who are pissed off at the Academy, is support other awards, you know. The Academy only has the prestige because we give it to it. So we need to participate and uplift other awards. I mean, we, of course, all love Fangoria Chainsaw Awards. It's, you know, one that's solely focused on our favorite genre, and they do awesome stuff. Their presentation last year was so much fun to watch and just as much fun to participate. And thank you, Alma, for having Jacob and I on set. We had a blast.
Thanks, Alma. But
There's other ones too. There's the Rondo Awards. I think we were talking earlier about the Saturn Awards. Like, these are all valid award systems that are giving recognition to the genre films that normally wouldn't get that at the Academy. And I think the more that people support those, and the Spirit Awards, you know, with giving more focus on indies, I love that the Spirit Awards has a category where it's like movies made for X amount or less. That's fucking great. It really is the spirit of it, of indie, to recognize like, hey, they were able to pull this off for very little. So just support more awesome film fests, awards, and bring them up, get them to a higher pedigree so that they can get more support and do more awesome work, essentially.
And as a member of two critics groups, support your local Critics Guild Awards.
Yeah.
Because you have more of a chance of getting, although I was unsuccessful in my bid to get Mia Goth a nom in the San Diego Film Critics Awards, because, and this kind of pissed me off, because the same guy that I was talking to at Knock of the Cabin, he didn't even watch Pearl before nominees. I'm like, oh, bro, killing me.
There should be like a thing. I don't know how we do it, but they force all the critics to actually watch the movies that like are up for it. Understandably, that's a big task. There's a lot of fucking movies released in 1 year.
But also, here's my problem with that is that we do these things called think lists where you mention things you're excited about. And some people use this just to list all the movies they've watched in the year. You know, that's unreasonable. But if there's something that you're excited about, you put on this list, and then we compile it, send it out to everyone. And Mia Goth showed up. Yeah, if it's mentioned by more than one person, we have the number of people it's mentioned that person's mentioned by. And Mia Goth had a bunch of people mention her. So everyone who hadn't seen it at that point should have gone and seen it. But sometimes they think, oh, a slasher. But we did nominate Danielle Deadwyler, so we did better than the Oscars. All right, let's call this one an episode. Before we go, let's look back on 100 episodes, and I'm kind of putting you guys on the spot.
Uh-oh.
So I'll go first. Boy. Favorite moment from the 100 episodes, and I think you guys know what mine is.
Well,
our interview with Charlie Clouser.
I was about to say, have you mentioned how much you liked doing that interview?
This episode. No, I just think it was... Honestly, I've wondered about Nine Inch Nails, Broken Equipment for like 30 years, and I finally got to ask a member of the band at that time about it. So what about you, Jacob?
I'd have to say when we had Stephen Kostanski on, both because it was fun to talk about Psycho Goreman, and it was fun to kind of do our tradition of surprising the guest with saying, and I'm blank, and that one was a particularly memorable instance.
I don't know if we've actually talked about it on the podcast on how that keeps happening, but we do keep failing to mention the sign off to our guests. And it's kind of become a bit where like an unintentional bit where if you ever hear a guest question who they are at the end, or it sounds weird, it's because we forget to mention it and kind of put them on the spot at the end.
Cause that's what Steve Kostanski did. His was a question. I'm Steve Kostanski. what about you, Korea?
To pick a single moment is really hard. It's like picking your favorite child, because I'm involved in the pre of these episodes so much. So I'm seeking out people or interacting with people who reach out to us, and I'm just always so happy when we get guests on and we click. So to pick a single moment is hard, because we've been so fortunate as a podcast to click with just about every single one of our guests. I can't think of one where we didn't have an awesome back and forth. And, you know, this is a self-find, you know, iHorror is our home and they help, they pay for the bills to keep it up on the site. But everything else about this is just the four of us. It's the three hosts and Lindsay. Our silent partner in this. And to see it pay off, and we feel it in the moment when we're talking with people, it's just so gratifying. We get no money for this. We put what we can, time and money into it. And it's really great, feeling that. We don't always see interactions with people who listen. When we get those interactions, that's great too. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we've been doing this for 5 years now and it doesn't feel like a job and certainly feels more than a hobby. So yeah, to pick a single moment, it's
I was going
to
say, have you given us an answer?
Yeah, I can't, I won't, I refuse. I love doing this. I love chatting with everybody.
Fun moment we did have, and you might know the guy's name because I don't, because you passed it on to us, but the guy who said that he was late for work because he was listening to our Heather Wixon interview, because that one ran long.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, oh, I got so into it, I was late to work.
That was one of the highest compliments. And yeah, we need Heather back. She put out a second volume of her book. Mm-hmm. Heather, I don't know if you're listening, but I'm going to DM you real soon.
Yeah, we need to have her back for that. We told her we'd have her back for every volume.
Yeah.
So we're behind.
But yeah, if you're reflecting on these past five seasons are enjoying it, remember to subscribe. Reviews are huge. So please go out there and place your honest opinions on us. That'll help with our numbers. And again, you know, we've done five full seasons without sponsors or asking for money. So, I mean, I think that's pretty cool. You know, I think that's my favorite moment, is just how we've just been doing this no matter what.
Because we're friends.
We generally, before we hit record, we generally will shoot the shit for usually like 20 minutes or so. And I always joke with these guys that if we ever do set up a Patreon, which, you know, I don't know, that's not really in the plans. But if we do, we just should release the bullshitting we do before we hit
record. Yeah, that's what the people want.
That'll be a Patreon only, just us shooting the shit.
And our commentary track to Rampage. That's right.
Yes.
We're not going a full season without mentioning Rampage, motherfuckers. I just got a Japanese 4K of it, and it is dope.
Okay.
Rampage will never die.
On the mention of Rampage, we're going to call this one an episode. So thank you for joining us for five seasons, if you have. Or thank you for joining us for this episode, if this is your first one. And if this is your first one, go back to Jarley Clouser, go back to Stephen Kostanski, go back to Heather Wixon. Those are the good ones. Those are the fun ones.
And don't forget the Justin's episode, Martel and the Liberty. The Justins, were fantastic.
Yeah. Any episode that Emma is on, we've had her twice. Any episode that Kelly and Bree are on, I think, has Kelly been three times now?
She's up there. Our episodes Waylon's with been Waylon.
Yeah.
Our episodes with Benji. Come on. If we have a guest on, you should check out those episodes.
Absolutely.
Everyone we've had on has been great.
Our music is by Restless Spirit, so go give them a listen. And our artwork is by Chris Fisher, so go give him a like. You can find us on any of the socials under Ion Horror or at ihorror.com. All right. So we will see you in a couple of weeks. With more horror. So for me, James J. Edwards.
I'm Jacob Davison.
And I'm Jonathan Correa.
Keep your eye on horror.